In 1985, Terry Gross talked with Beverly Sills about her career and her life. It was 5 years after she'd retired from performing and 5 years into her tenure as the general director of the New York City Opera.
You're one of the few singers of your generation who made a career by studying and performing in America. Were you told when you were getting started that you'd really better go to Europe if you expected to really have a singing career?
Well, yes. Actually, I received a Fulbright, which I didn't accept after going through all the business of making the tapes and presentations. There simply wasn't enough money for me to just take off and go to Europe. My mother was widowed. I had two brothers in school becoming doctors under the GI Bill. But there was very limited funds. My mother was alone. I just felt that I was going to have to make it here. I just didn't feel I had the luxury of going abroad. And something inside me made me resent the fact that I couldn't make a living singing opera in my own country.
You didn't sing at the Met until 1975.
Right.
Why do you think it took them that long to invite you to sing there? Do you think it had to do with your lack of European
performance? No, it had to do with Rudolph Bing, period. Mm-hmm. I said that I would never sing at the Met until Mr. Bing retired. And the day after he retired, I signed the contract with Gendler, and that was that.
What was it between you and he?
Well, it started out, of course, with the idea that he really didn't feel that the American artist could add to the prestige of the Metropolitan Opera. It is true that he was there in glorious times when there was Tibaldi and Delmonico and Corelli and Bastianini and, you know, so who needed the American? He had a great wealth of European artists to choose from. He also wrote a book about me, and about me he wrote, "How could a girl from Brooklyn know anything about singing the queens of Donizetti?" It's interesting. Why should a girl from Brooklyn know less than, let's say, a lady from Spain? Or, I mean, English queens are English queens. It was just an attitude he had. We have since, you know, become very close friends. He had a radio program and invited me to go on it, which I thought took a lot of courage on his part. And we found we had same kind of humor. And he announced on the radio that I was his biggest mistake and that his greatest regret was not that I didn't sing at the Met because I proved that I didn't need the Met, but that we could have been friends for 20 years and that he regrets.
One of the turning points in your career was when you sang the role of Cleopatra in Julius Caesar, and it was critically acclaimed.
Yeah, that was the turning point.
Now, you had told Julius Riddell, the head of the New York City Opera, that if he hired someone outside the company for the role of Cleopatra, as he had been considering doing, that you were going to quit.
Yes.
Did it ever dawn on you that he might have said, well, then, goodbye?
Yes. Oh, he said to me, "You're not going to quit." I said, "Yes, I am." Well, he said, "How will that accomplish your singing Cleopatra?" And I said, "I will do my first New York recital at Carnegie Hall. Peter, my husband, has offered to give it to me as a present. And I will sing all five of the Cleopatra arias that are in your version." And he burst out laughing. I said to him, "Julius, take someone inside the company, not me, and I won't open my mouth. But going outside implies there's nobody within who can do it. And that simply isn't true. And it's just too demeaning. I'll never fight you on taking another soprano who's with us. That's you're the director of the company. You're supposed to take the one that you feel does it best. But to go outside means there's nobody here who can do it. And that's just a lie. So I don't accept it."
Had you ever done anything like that before?
No.
Give an ultimatum like that?
No, but you understand, in 1966, I was already 37 years old. I wasn't a young singer. In the past, when I had first begun, I didn't have financial security. It was hard for me to walk away from any job that paid me anything. I was a married woman. And my husband was a very successful businessman, and it didn't worry me that I might not have enough money. My mother was cared for. Both my brothers were doctors already. So, you know, life was moving on. And singing was not the be-all and end-all in my life. I had my husband and my family. I had a very good life outside of the opera house, so I didn't feel desperate. And I was never terribly ambitious. I never dreamed this career would happen. I wanted to sing because I loved to sing. I really did. I couldn't wait to get to the theater to sing. But when I made that ultimatum, I made it with the idea that, yes, he could say, look, that's my decision. I also made it from a very secure feeling of knowing that at that moment I was doing all the parts in Hoffmann for him, Donna Anna, the Queen of the Night, Constanza, and the Abduction from the Seraglio. You don't replace me that easily. You have somebody who every fourth night can walk in and do four of the most difficult things in the repertoire. You don't just dismiss her lightly. And coming up were a tremendous number of projects that required my capabilities, such as they were, and he knew it. But in the case of the Cleopatra, it was the opening night of the new theater, the opening night of its first grand opera season. I felt I had stuck with the company. I'd been with it 11 years at that point. I just felt that opening night should have been mine, particularly since the role was made for my voice.
Do you think you sang especially well that first night?
Yes, I think I did. I think the excitement caught on. I think Tregel and I were at our very, very best. I looked up at one point and I thought, my God, he's a singing Gielgud. You know, it was an extraordinary moment. I think that opening night, nobody could have touched us.
Beverly Sills speaking with Terry Gross in 1985. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 1985 interview with Beverly Sills, who died earlier this week.
Throughout your career in opera, you have been known as not only an excellent singer, but as an excellent actress as well. And I'd really like for you to tell a story that you relay in your memoir about working with Pavarotti and your fear that after he took an aria, he was going to bow and like break with the role momentarily, and you didn't want that to happen.
No, well, you know, we had different training, really. When you grow up with the New York City Opera, which is a repertory company, you find yourself playing cameo roles one night and four nights later you're the leading lady. So there really isn't time to think about curtain calls and bows. Luciano is a very warm individual. That's not a play that he acts out when he's on stage. I think the hanky came later, but the ebullience and the outpouring comes from the man himself. And it is a kind of love affair he has with the public. And when they applaud a lot, he just likes to acknowledge and say thank you right away. I did go to see him and beg him not to do that. And I said to him, you know, everything we do will bring the house down if we do it well, because Bellini is one showstopper after another. And it's disconcerting, and I got that crazy mad scene coming up. I've got to start the character right from the beginning, and she's such a elusive girl anyhow. It's not like Lucia that is, you know, builds to a terrific, terrific madness. This is just kind of wacky. And I said to him, you know, let's not bow. And he said, I can promise. And we had this big duet ending in a great big embrace with our heads in each other's necks, sort of. And the house came down, and suddenly they were still applauding, and he said to me, one little bow, Bevelina. And I said, no. So he bit me in the neck, and of course I pulled back, and there we were. Certainly looked to the audience as if we were bowing.
Are there any conventions in opera that you think are really pretensions of opera that you'd like to see stripped away, like the hanky, for instance?
Yes. Yeah, I'd like to see all pretensions in opera stripped away. I'd like to see a much more naturalistic approach to the acting. Corelli had it. He knew how to lean back against the wall and sing the third act aria in Tosca. Just by putting his hands in his pockets. I hate operatic poses. I think we shouldn't be afraid to turn our backs on the audience while we're singing, if it's a natural movement to make. I think we shouldn't hesitate to sing an ugly tone if the word we're saying is an ugly one that should be spit out and not prettily voiced. And I'd like to see lighting much more naturalistic. If it's a hot summer Mediterranean day, I'd like you to feel that the people are sweaty. It's a given that I'd like to have beautiful singing. I mean, there is no opera without a beautiful voice. But for me, that's only about 60% of the evening. The other 40 is to touch me emotionally and intellectually.
When you look back on your career in music now from the vantage point of being the director of the New York City Opera, are there any things that you really wish you could have done differently or want to change?
Nothing. There isn't even a role I left undone. It's funny. I would have perhaps liked to have sung more in Europe, but with my children, that was impossible to put so much distance between us. Other than that, can't think of a single thing I'd have done differently.
Beverly Sills speaking with Terry Gross in 1985. She died earlier this week at the age of 78. Her farewell performance was on October 27, 1980, after 25 years performing with the New York City Opera. She ended the evening with her rendition of the Portuguese folk song, Tell Me Why. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.